We've been looking at the resurrection of Jesus, and for you that were not here in our first session, you've got to know what the first century tomb looked like. Here is the tomb, inside of the tomb, which was ground level. You didn't go 6 feet under. You didn't go under anything. You went into a tomb. And consequently, from ground level out here, you would walk into the tomb, ground level there. Along the sides of the tomb, along the walls, would be as many as three or four niches. And into the niche went the body, and each niche had the flat part for the neck on down, and then a little elevated stone on which the head rested. And this was, then in front you had the stone, rolling stone. A rolling stone in front of the tomb, which was in a niche. That was often, you'd roll the tomb up. This would be equivalent to our opening a door. And this is the way you expose the inside. And we'll want to note that as the disciples arrived at the tomb, what they actually saw. You know, I know we've been over the resurrection many, many times. But may I emphasize something that is so important, because we are going over some basic things. These things really need to be repeated for things that we do not know. It's easy, so easy to be smug. The resurrection, I've heard all about that. Did you know that nobody was impressed that the resurrection had occurred by seeing an empty tomb? None of them. You know, the only place the empty tomb is mentioned is in the gospel accounts. It's not in the book of Acts. The book of Acts emphasizes the resurrection. And we'll want to try to ask and answer. Why is it that we cannot say that in the book of Acts, the apostle preached that the tomb was empty? None of them did. That was not what convinced them that the resurrection had occurred at all. What convinced them? His appearances. They saw him. And this is the thing that brought the conviction that, in other words, in the Gospels, they note that the tomb is empty, but they didn't know why. Why is it empty? Why isn't he here? What does this mean? This is all reserved for later in the book of Acts, and that's one thing that I learned in studying it for the umpteenth time, that there was something there that I had really overlooked. And this is often true with Bible study. We need to look and relook at the things that we may have totally missed before. Now, as the three accounts, the synoptics, tell us what happened, they all have identical words at one point. Look at Matthew 28 and verse 6. Matthew 28 and verse 6. These words are found identically in Mark 16:6, Matthew 28:6, as we're looking at, and Luke 24 verse 6. And here are the words. He is not here, for he has risen. And so you have a couplet of phrases. One, he is not here. And then that is coupled with something. And then you have the words, he is risen. And then you have something attached to that. But the word spoken, recorded by all the Gospels, is he is not here, he is risen. And by the way, none of this is human discovery. None of this is the disciple or Mary or one of the women coming out and saying, why, he is not here, he is risen. No man ever said these words. These words were spoken by God. We've been covering basic doctrines. The fact that these words came topside down, not man's side, man's discovery, they were, is the doctrine of what?
Boy, do we ever need to repeat if you're serious. What is the top side down doctrine? Doctrine of Revelation. And Revelation means man does not discover, but God opens up and reveals and makes known. And the fact that he is not here, he is risen, is confirmed by men, but it is revealed by God. And you notice that it's an angelic messenger in each case that brings this news to those that are there. Now notice the link, 28:6. He is not here, for he has risen. Now notice the two connections. Just as he said, come see the place where he was lying. So the words, he is not here, is coupled with an invitation to see. An invitation to see. He is risen is coupled with an invitation to believe, because it says he is not here as he has said. So the first is an invitation to see, and he is risen is an invitation to believe his words. Or let's put it a different way. The first one, he is not here, appeal to your senses. Take a look. You go and look and see if he's there. This is an appeal to senses. He says, he is risen. And for that, I want you to appeal to his words. Didn't he say that he would do so? Now we want to look at a little series of statements made by Jesus, and we'll generalize, then look at it. Jesus, I have listed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 different places where he clearly prophesies his resurrection. But the thing we want to note is this. Two things always go together. They're never separate. He never predicts his death without also predicting his resurrection. You never see the remark, I'm going to Jerusalem to die. He never, ever says that. He will say, I'm going to Jerusalem to die, and then after the third day be raised. There is never a prediction of his death without a prediction of his resurrection. Now, it's very hard for us to grasp that. So I put down a little sentence that I want to make a prophecy. And it is as follows, and I want you to freely give your reaction to it, which I know what it will be. I will be gone Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday this week. I'm on the way to Washington, D.C., the capital. I will suffer many things from the nation's officials. I will be brutally killed tomorrow. And in 3 days, I'll be back because I will rise from the dead. He say, call the white coats. Take him away. Because no person can make such a prediction. Well, when we look at the four books of the Gospels, Jesus made just such a prediction. And let's take a look at a couple of them. First of all is Matthew 16:21. And in this section, Jesus gives a fairly detailed prophecy of where he is going, what will happen, and who will be involved. Matthew 16:21. From that time, Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem. That's the place. And suffer many things from the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes. And be killed, and be raised up on the third day. I repeat, never does Jesus predict his death, never does he predict his suffering, without also predicting his resurrection. Now, what is the difference between forecast and prophecy? Well, the major difference is prophecy is always precise. It always gives place, time, or often gives time, place, who is involved, and details. I have not prophesied if I say it is going to rain this week. It's a good chance that that will probably be. That is not a prophecy. A true prophecy from the Bible would be it will rain Thursday morning for 5 minutes from 10 till 10:05. And it will also give you the amount of rain that is to fall. Now that's a little different than saying it's going to rain this weekend. The character of biblical prophecy is its precision. And we could go to hundreds. One of the most dramatic ones is what happens to Tyre and Sidon that is minutely fulfilled in history after the prediction of the destruction of those cities were concerned. And that's the character of biblical prophecy. Well, and by the way, when he said these words in verse 21, what words just absolutely went right by the apostles? They had no idea what he was saying. Verse 21, as far as the disciples was concerned, went this way. From that time, Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders, the chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and brrr. That's all they heard. They didn't grasp one other thing. And they will announce, as John does, that when he saw that empty tomb, he did not know the resurrection had occurred. In fact, the women, when they see the empty tomb, what's their first thought? Who stole the body? That's a little bit contrary to the opinion that is, well, the resurrection is not true. The disciples were excited, and they thought they saw a resurrection. They did no such thing. That was the last thing. They suggested grave robbery. They suggested that somebody had, on a friendly sense, taken the body away. But none of them ever looked in that tomb and said, "He is risen," until much, much later on. So Matthew 16:21 is a precise prophecy, as well as, and I'm simply going to give you these rather than go to them, Matthew 17:9, Matthew 17:22 and 23, Matthew 20:18 and 19, Matthew 26:32, and Mark 9:10, and Luke 9:22, and these are only a few. Now, let's begin to look at some of the evidence that is revolves about the empty tomb of Jesus. And for that, let's go to the book of Matthew, chapter 27. Matthew 27, verse 62-66. Now on the next day, which is the one after the preparation, the chief priests and Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I am to rise again.'" So the ones who put him to death remembered that. And as they sleep on it, it begins to disturb them, because they begin to think, those rascals, I bet the disciples, it wouldn't be past them to come out and steal that body away and then announce to the city that he has raised from the dead as he said. And they take this to Pilate, and they said, "We need to do something to secure the grave. Therefore," verse 64, "give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day, lest the disciples come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He is risen from the dead,' and that last deception will be worse than the first." And as is true with the sovereignty of God, God says, that's a wonderful deal. That will challenge me to stay in a sealed tomb behind the guards. And so in the context, you have verse 65. It is one of the first things I want you to look at is the presence at the tomb of the guards. Presence at the tomb of the guards. Pilate said to them, verse 65, you have a guard. Or this could be imperative mood. Take a guard. Take a guard and make it as secure as you know how. So the first thing we want to note is a detachment of Roman soldiers. These guards would be Roman soldiers. And the Roman soldiers were to make secure the tomb. The word in Greek for soldier is custodion, our English word custodian. And in the Roman military, the discipline was tremendous. Very simply, Polybius records the fact that the fear of punishment produced faultless attention to duty, especially at night. The ancient histories list 18 different reasons why a soldier could be executed. And let's pretend that I'm a recruiting officer to recruit Roman guards or recruit you for the Roman military. And I want you to know what you're getting into before we begin. Here are the 18 causes for putting a soldier to death. One, a scout who is sent out and remains with the enemy. Death penalty. Two, desertion. Death penalty. Losing your arms. I don't mean arms. I mean arms, but arms metaphorically. Your sword. You lose your sword, you die. Disobedience in wartime. Going over a wall or a rampart that was intended to contain you. Sounds like Bill Clinton. Starting a mutiny, refusing to protect an officer, or deserting your post. These are all death sentence now. And we have historical examples of them being executed. Hiding from service. You don't want to get drafted in the military? Well, hide. That's death penalty. Murder is death penalty. Laying hands on a superior to insult him. Fleeing when the act would influence others. You ran from military service and some other people saw you do it. You ought to die for that. So said the Romans. We're soft, aren't we? So soft compared with some of these things. Betraying plans to the enemy. Wounding a fellow soldier with a sword. Attempting suicide. If you attempt to avoid duty by killing yourself, we'll finish it. Leaving a night watch, striking an officer while you're being punished by that officer, escaping the guardhouse, disturbing the peace. So when we read that there were guards sent to the tomb, they didn't have on Pinkerton Union uniforms. These were real Roman soldiers who were extremely strong there. So, what is the likelihood of these guys falling asleep? Would you fall asleep if you were knew you would be killed for it? There was another that was practiced by the temple police, and this illustrates how often background helps in a passage. The Jewish guard, the high priest or the chief priest would make his rounds nightly. And if before he arrived, you were not on your feet saying, I'm on duty, sir, he could do one of two things. And you could not resist. Number one, he could beat you. Number two, if you were asleep, he could pour fluid on your garments and light them. And you would burn. Look at Revelation chapter 16. Revelation 16. It's just a little parenthesis to show how the background helps out a great deal. Remember, the Bible is written against the culture and the geography of its times. And if we do not understand that, we do not understand the Bible. We illustrated some time back out of the book of Song of Solomon, where the young man commends the young lady he is so in love with by saying, "Your hair is like a flock of goats." Wouldn't you love to hear your husband say that to you? Or, "You are my mare," M-A-R-E. "You are my horse." And that makes no sense at all. And that's because the Bible is written in the light of its times and in the light of its cultures. So notice verse 15, "Behold, I am coming like a thief. Blessed is the one who stays awake." What's the next phrase? "And keeps his garments." They would have understood that perfectly well. Because when you fall asleep at your post and your chief officer comes along, he has the option to beat you or burn you. And he would burn you by lighting your garments. And so notice the flood of light that the background throws on this particular passage. All right, back to Matthew 27. We're talking about a heavily disciplined military. Now look at the other thing that is there. Verse 66, it says, "They went..." By the way, a detachment of guards could run anywhere from a minimum of 10. So here are 10 Roman soldiers dispatched to watch the scene. And they all fall asleep. No, they didn't. They wouldn't dare fall asleep in the light of the Roman military. And so verse 66, "They went and made the grave secure. Along with the guard, they also put a seal on it." Now let's go back to our picture once again of the Roman tomb, or what a tomb was like. How did they go about sealing a tomb like this? Well, the Roman did it by taking a long string, and they would attach it with sealing wax. This thing would be rolled over here and shut. And they would put sealing wax on each side of the tomb. And it's not that that would physically, because you could break that thing, but when you broke it, you defied Rome. The disciples would have been dead had they come and broken that seal. And so the seal was the sign of Roman authority, securing this grave. Look for an example at Daniel chapter 6. Daniel 6. This was a very ancient custom and a way of sealing grave, or sealing a document for that matter. Daniel chapter 6, and we're looking at verse 17. This was done to put the government authority behind the placing of Daniel. And chapter 6, verse 17, "A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den." This is where Daniel is placed. "And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of his nobles, so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel." So notice the seal was used in order to secure, in order to see that it was carried out. So what do we have? We have a scene with the tomb, with a very heavy stone in front of it. You have the string across it, attached to both ends, and you have Roman guards standing there to see that nothing happened at the grave at all. Keep in mind, behind the seal was all of the authority of Rome. Now, let's look at the stone itself. And for that, let's go to John chapter 20. No, let's go to Matthew. Matthew. Now, the gospel accounts are often different. They are never contradictory. Simply because a different author sees a different thing. We could easily illustrate that if we would take a man and a woman and send them to a wedding and get the woman's account of the wedding and get the man's account. The man will doubtless give great detail to her dress. He will notice everything about the dress. No, he doesn't even see the dress, probably. A woman would give a different account. And therefore, doesn't mean any of them are inaccurate. It simply means they see different things. Now, when this tomb is observed to be open, the gospel writers see different things. They're just little touches, little minor touches that are somewhat different. The first one is found in Matthew 27 and verse 60. And he laid it, the body, in his own tomb, in the own new tomb, which he had hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a large stone. The word used for rolled here, actually the word roll is kuleo. K-U-L-I-O. Kuleo means to roll. However, you can put different prepositions on the front. Do you mean roll away? Do you mean roll toward? Or what else could you do? Do you mean roll over? Is there any difference between rolling over someone and rolling to someone or rolling from someone? Well, the Matthew notice that it was rolled, and he puts the word pros on the front, and it means to spatially. It means to spatially. It refers to physical distance. And so, you might put the verse 60, they rolled the stone up against the grave. The idea is that the entryway is blocked by something that has rolled over it and is touching it and is spatially against it. That's what Matthew noted when the grave was sealed, that the stone that was in front of it actually touched the tomb itself. And the emphasis that Matthew would make is there's not room enough to throw a cat through the between the door of the tomb and the rock itself. It was rolled up against that. Look at Mark 16. Mark chapter 16. Verses 3 and 4. And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away. And here in Mark, he uses the same word, root word, kuleo, that means to roll. Only the thing that impressed him is not that it was against, it's the fact that it wasn't. And he puts on the front of it the word apa. and it means from spatially. Proskuleo, to spatially, and this means from spatially. So what one confirms as sealing the tomb, the other says is, I was impressed with the way it was unsealed. Now look at John 20. John 20. Now again, we need to keep in mind what a tomb looked like. Keep in mind that this was the stone, very heavy stone, very heavy. Often as much as 18 inches thick and as tall as 6 or 7 feet. And I have no idea what a stone 18 inches around and 6 feet tall would weigh. But one thing for sure, it ain't a frisbee. So this is a very heavy thing. And in order to facilitate its movement, there was a track along here that went level for a while, and then it went up so that when they wanted to open the tomb, they could roll the stone back in it, and they could chalk it with another rock to keep it from rolling back. And Matthew is impressed that this stone completely closed off the door. Luke is observed that it isn't touching the door. It's spatially removed from it. And John says, did you see something else? And notice his account does not talk about it being rolled. John chapter 20 verse 1, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came early to the tomb while it was still dark, and saw the stone. Now the rest have said rolled. This one says taken. One of the first Greek words you learn, any first year student, it's part of his early vocabulary, knows what the word airo means, A-I-R-O. You know that the word airo is a word that means to bear. It means to carry. And John notes that the stone has been carried away. Now see the word from? The word from is the word we're familiar with in Greek. Even you who know no Greek, is the word ek. It's the word that preposition that means out of, as a source. Now, we might be able then to paraphrase. What John sees is a stone is not only rolled away, it has been carried out of its track. How in the world did the door get off of the hinges? There were at least 10 Roman guards who were there, who if they slept, they were dead. And there was the Roman seal across the face of the tomb, and across the face, which meant Roman authority. And so they come and John says, what in the world has happened here? But please note, none of them say, why, I guess he's risen. John doesn't say it. Peter doesn't say it. They were not convinced by the empty tomb. You know what they were convinced by? He appeared to us. We have seen him. And there are some 14 references in the New Testament to those that saw him. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This is what convinced them. As convincing as an empty tomb might be, they tried every explanation they knew to why he wasn't there. But they didn't say he's risen. They said, someone has taken him. And they asked the gardener, who has taken the Lord? Have to be a tremendously courageous person. In the first place, how did you get around the guards? Well, the account says that God just gave the guards a little anesthetic. And what did the Roman authority say, don't touch this tomb, mean to God? All right, 1 Corinthians chapter 15 gives us a narrative of that. Verse 3, for I delivered unto you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared. Question, what is the word appeared in English? What voice is it? He appeared. What voice is that? Active or passive? It's active, isn't it? It's the subject producing the action. He said, he appeared, he went, he did something. It's active. That is not correct. This is a passive voice. And I think your King James has it correctly when it says, and that he was seen. How many got that in your... you should have that, because that is correct. He was seen by Peter... then, at a different time, in a different place, to the 12, brethren at one time, most of whom remain alive now. In other words, if you want to ask these people if what they saw, go ahead and ask them. Some of them are still alive. Then he appeared to James, or he was seen by James, then all the apostles, and last of all, by me. And then he mentions later on, that he was seen of 500. So you have an abundance. I believe there's something like, maybe you can correct me, I believe there's something like 14 post-resurrection appearances of Jesus at different times, to different places, to different people. And therefore, that account is very clear. However, let's take one last look into the grave. And that's in John chapter 20, verses 4 through 8. Oh, by the way, you know Jesus did have some opponents. Pharisees, many of the Jews, of course, crucified him, and the Gentiles. All they would have had to do to stop Christianity on its first day was produce a body. The guards come to the... what's a little incident with the guards that happens? They witness to the resurrection and they come to the Jewish high priest and he said... how much can I pay you to lie about it? There was an attempt to bribe them, to make them lie about it, because it was obvious to everyone in Jerusalem, the grave is empty. And even his enemies said, we'll pay you to shut up. That was the reality of the resurrection. Why don't you have anything about the empty tomb in the book of Acts? Because everybody knew the tomb was empty. They didn't know why. But they knew it was empty. There's not one enemy of Jesus that ever in any way says, we can produce a body, give us 24 hours. They had all kinds of time and nobody, even his enemies, produced a body. All right, John chapter 20, and let's see what John sees in verse 4. The grave was empty in the sense that there was no body there. The grave was not empty in that the grave clothes remained. Okay, notice the first thing that is seen in verse 4. And the two were running together, and the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter.
Is that local color? Is that something you probably wouldn't have observed if you hadn't have been there? Well, John was there. And John is a part of local color is that Peter and I were running together, and I outran Peter. I was faster than he was, and I came to the tomb first. Some of you remember last Sunday I reported the little incident in the Antioch lot. The more I think about it, you know, I don't know what happened. Well, I was there, but boy, when you're excited, you don't see well, do you? When you're excited, there's a lot of things that you don't observe. And they're obviously excited because they've heard the tomb is empty. And so, verse 5, stooping, he peeks in. I think that's much better with the Greek word. He stoops and peeks in, and he saw the linen wrappings lying there. Now, the linen wrappings lying simply says, it's a strange scene, I see everything they wrapped the body in, except there's no body. This is not a tomb where you're raised from the dead, and boy, I tell you, if I was raised from the dead, I would rip those things off so quick, and believe me, I wouldn't take time to neatly fold the headpiece. I don't even do that with my covers in the morning. I just rip them off and get out of bed. There is no disorder in the tomb. It's all together. And so John sees the linen wrappings, not any other word, but lying there. They're not unwound. They're just lying there. And so if you can picture the body wrapped with this, and you might look back at chapter 19 and noticed one other thing about burial, that they had requested the burial spices. Verse 39, Nicodemus came also, who had first come to him by night, bringing a mixture of aloes and myrrh, about 100 pounds. And the custom was to lay the body, to wash it, and to start to wrap it in linen. You went around the first time. The second time, you put the spices in the folds, wound it again, put more spices in, until you had around the body 100 pounds of spices, all wrapped in linen strips. And John looks in, and what does he see? The linen cloths are lying there. It's not unwound. Remember part of the excitement at the bringing forth of Lazarus? Look at John 11. John 11. Coming down to chapter 11, verse 43. And when he had said these things, he's at the grave of Lazarus, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, out. There's no verb. Lazarus, out. And he who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings. And his face was wrapped around with a cloth, and Jesus said to him, poor guy can't move. Unbind him and let him go. Does it dawn on you that this guy, all wrapped up in these things, can't go anywhere? So would you please have presence of mind to unwind him? Jesus did not get unwound. The body simply left the grave clothes where they are. And notice the emphasis back to John for closing, chapter 20 and verse 7. The order, it says the face cloth, which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up or folded up in a place by itself.
Now that would be an obvious, stunning type scene, but the emphasis is it's all orderly. And they look at that empty grave, and there is the form of a body, and there is the headpiece, but there's no head there, there's no body there. Jesus has simply come forth. Well, how could he do that? He is the Son of God. And on this Sunday morning, Jesus has come forth from the grave. The evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is really overwhelming. There is no other way to explain the empty tomb. And our Father, we're thankful for the empty tomb. We're thankful that you were raised. And we're thankful that you appeared to many, many men and women. You ate with them. You talked with them. You communed with them as the living, resurrected Lord Jesus Christ. Help us to understand this as the pivotal doctrine of Christianity, that Jesus Christ who died is today alive, and we anticipate his return once again in the future. In whose name we pray. Amen.